my people and my land of Israel. We now look to our brother David.
My beloved brothers and sisters, in the Lord Jesus Christ and in the glorious hope of Israel which we share. There can be no doubt whatsoever as to the identity of the nation whose land is prophesied here in Ezekiel chapter 38 as being invaded by the confederacy of Gog from the north. It is Israel. We're told that in the chapter. Neither can there be any doubt as to the time period when these things will take place. It shall be in the latter days. We're told that, again, in the chapter, the latter days of the kingdom of men. Neither can there be any doubt as to the purpose that God has in bringing these things to pass. It is that he may be known in the eyes of many nations. Again, we're told that. Neither can there be any doubt as to whose land it is that is going to be violated in this way, or whose people it is that are going to suffer this outrage. It is my people of Israel, says God. And again, it is my land, he tells us. It's all there in the chapter. In fact, the very essence of what we've just been saying there, brothers and sisters, is all there in one verse. Verse 16, speaking of the confederacy of Gog, thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen or nations may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. And so in that verse, verse 16, we have a summary of what the whole of the chapter is about. The identity is given of the perpetrator of this oppression, Gog. The identity is given of those who are going to suffer this oppression, God's people of Israel. We're given the geographical location of where this oppression is going to take place, God's land of Israel. And we're given the time period when it will take place, in the latter days. And we are given there the purpose as to why God is going to bring this about, that the nations may be brought to a knowledge of God when he shall be sanctified before their eyes. There it is, brothers and sisters, all in one verse. The only thing that verse 16 doesn't tell us, although it's implied, is what happens to that northern invader after it has invaded the land of Israel. But the remainder of Ezekiel chapter 38 and the whole of Ezekiel chapter 39 leave us in no doubt as to what happens, how that it is to be destroyed upon the mountains of Israel, such that God's name and God's purpose may be made known and vindicated to all the peoples of the earth. Now we read here in verse 18 of chapter 38, and it shall come to pass when Gog shall come against the land of Israel, saith the Lord God, that my fury shall come up in my face. And we go on to read in the next verse, verse 19, of God's jealousy and the fire of God's wrath. Why then do we read of God's fury coming up into his face? Well, surely, brothers and sisters, it's because of what we've already read there in verse 16. It is God's land that is going to be invaded. It is God's people that are going to be violated. And we read of Israel in Zechariah 2, verse 8, he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of God's eye. And so no wonder, brothers and sisters, that we read of this reaction from God when this evil confederacy of nations makes its move against his people and against his land, when they will attempt to put into practice that evil thought of which we read at the end of verse 10, that evil thought that will come into their mind to go up, verse 11, to the land of unwalled villages, to go to them that are at rest and that dwell safely. And for what purpose? Verse 12, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations and that dwell in the midst of the land. Now, of course, some might argue, well, how can this be speaking of the nation of Israel as we see them today? How can we maintain that these events are due to take place shortly when Israel are described in the terms stated here, being at rest and dwelling safely? Surely, they say, Israel can hardly be described as being at rest now, because they are surrounded on nearly all sides by Arab nations that are hostile to the Jewish cause and are totally bent, the majority of them, on Israel's destruction. It is a fact, of course, that for the last 43 years, ever since the re-establishment of the nation of Israel in May 1948, it has been the ambitious boast of the Arabs to drive Israel out of the land and to drive them into the Mediterranean Sea and get rid of them altogether. They've made various attempts to achieve that, but each time they have tried, they have met with absolute, total and dismal failure. They have waged war on Israel three times in those 43 years, and each time Israel has emerged victorious, despite the fact that they have been absolute overwhelming odds against her. That does not mean, of course, that Israel has ever been able to relax its defences. Far from it. Israel spends 40% of its gross national product on defence. That is a phenomenal amount. 40% of its gross national turnover goes on defence. But it does mean, brothers and sisters, that Israel has a great confidence in its own arm of strength, in its own ability to look after itself. Israel does not fear any nation, except for one. It has a fear of the nation of Russia. Apart from that, it does not fear any nation. As we know, brothers and sisters, in the centre margin of our Bibles, that word safely in verse 11 is rendered confidently. And Israel is a confident nation. Sadly, however, that confidence is misplaced. It is a confidence in its own arm of flesh rather than a confidence and a trust in God. And one would have thought that in view of Israel's history, throughout all the record of the Old Testament, never mind the last 43 years, Israel, one would have hoped, would have had more faith and trust in God and less trust in its own arm of strength. But sadly, that is not the case. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why God is going to allow this calamity to overtake his people, that they might be brought to a realization that their faith and their trust and their confidence should be in God rather than in themselves. And it is for that purpose that he is going to demonstrate to Israel, as he will then ultimately snatch them, literally from the brink of total annihilation and destruction, that it is he, God, working through his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, the one whom they crucified and betrayed 1900 years ago, that has now wrought their deliverance. And thus we read in Ezekiel chapter 39 and verse 22, "So the house of Israel shall know that I am Yahweh their God from that day and forward." From that day and forward. And so we see then, brothers and sisters, that the purpose of the events prophesied in these chapters is to convince not just the Gentile nations of the power and the might of God, but that Israel herself might be convinced also of these things, and that they might be humbled to henceforth put their faith and their trust and their confidence in God rather than in their own arm of strength. But to return to chapter 38 and this word safely or confidently in chapter 38 verse 11. Strong's Concordance tells us that the original Hebrew word means a place of refuge, which of course is what Israel has been for many thousands of years, for many thousands of Jews who have fled from the persecution that has been raised against them, the persecution of anti-Semitism. The land of Israel has been a place of refuge for them. It was for that very reason that it became imperative to establish a national home for the Jew at the end of the Second World War, after the persecution of the Jews in Nazi-occupied Europe. And the newly formed state of Israel was looked upon then, and it still is to a certain extent, as a place of refuge, where the Jews can be free from racial intolerance, a racial intolerance that is still going on in certain parts of the world, including Russia. And similarly with this word rest here in verse 11, speaking of the Jews in Israel being at rest, it means repose, to be settled, to be still. And although it isn't actually the same word in the original Hebrew as the word that we're just about to quote, nevertheless, the meanings of these words are very similar. And therefore the sentiments expressed here in verse 11 of the people of Israel being at rest provide such a contrast to the words that we're just going to have a look now at in Deuteronomy chapter 28, if we turn there. Here, as we know, in the 28th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, we have some of the curses that were to be brought upon the people of Israel if they disobeyed God, which they did, of course, throughout their history. And in Deuteronomy 28, verse 64, we read, "And Yahweh shall scatter thee among all people, from the one end of the earth even unto the other, and there thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But Yahweh shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind. And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shall have none assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, Would God it were even. And at even thou shalt say, Would God it were morning, for the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see." Now, as we said, the word rest there in verse 65 isn't exactly the same word in the original Hebrew as is used in Ezekiel chapter 38. But it's been translated in both cases by the English word rest, because the meanings of those two words in the Hebrew are very, very similar anyway. This word here in Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 65 means a home, a settled spot, a place of rest. Now, when God fulfilled those verses that we've just been looking at in Deuteronomy 28, and when he scattered them throughout all the nations of the earth, that was exactly what the Jews were denied. A home, a place of rest, a settled spot. But since 1948, however, and exactly in accordance with Bible prophecy, the Jews now have a home, a settled spot, a place of rest. And that place is Israel. And so we see then from the conditions that prevail now in Israel that they answer to the description that is here given in Ezekiel chapter 38, such that these events could well be imminent for fulfillment. And we need to stress that, brothers and sisters, because there is an idea being put forward currently, and it has actually been in existence for some time now, that Russia's invasion of Israel will not actually take place until after Christ has returned, and until after he has been made himself known to the Jews, and after they have accepted him, and after he has been enthroned in Jerusalem. And those that put forward that idea maintain that Israel can only be at rest and dwell confidently when Christ has returned and when he has been accepted by the Jews and when he is enthroned in power in Israel and when Israel has been blessed materially and spiritually as a result of that. And that Russia will then see, they maintain, in Israel's newfound prosperity, a reason, they say, for coming down into the land of Israel to take a spoil and to take a prey, as we read in verse 12, and to carry away silver and gold and cattle and goods, as we read in verse 13. That's the idea that is being put forward. And it all sounds very plausible, brothers and sisters. But it overlooks at least one very important aspect. Namely, that if the Gogian invasion of the land of Israel is not to take place until after Christ has returned, until after he has manifested himself to the Jews, and until after they have accepted him, and until after he has been enthroned in Jerusalem, how is it then that in Ezekiel chapter 39 and verse 7, following on after the defeat of Gog, we have these words spoken by God? So will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people. And that word so follows on from a description of the invasion of the land of Israel by Gog and its destruction. So, says God, will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel. And again in verse 22 of that chapter, following on from a description of the burial of Gog, which of course is after its destruction, we read, so the house of Israel shall know that I am Yahweh their God from that day and forward. From that day and forward. And again at the end of chapter 39, speaking of Israel in verse 28, then shall they know that I am Yahweh their God. Again, following on after the destruction of Gog. And verse 29, neither shall I hide my face any more from them. And so all those references in chapter 39 of Ezekiel demonstrate clearly that the spiritual enlightenment of Israel does not take place until after the destruction of the Confederacy of Gog. As we said earlier, one of the reasons for this invasion of Israel is that the Jews that are then in the land are to be humble, that they might then ultimately acknowledge the might and the power of God demonstrated on their behalf when he delivers them from the hand of the aggressor. Now, God's claim to the land, which we know as Israel, and his decision to populate it with Abraham and his descendants goes back, of course, to the time of the book of Genesis when the land was known as Canaan, and it was promised to Abraham and his seed for an everlasting possession. Consequently, it was to the land of Canaan that God led his people under the leadership of Moses after he had brought his people out of Egypt and when he had brought them through the wilderness. If we turn to the book of Deuteronomy again, this time to chapter 11, we read a word spoken to Israel prior to their entering the land. Words which indicate to us the great love and the great esteem which God has for that particular region of the earth's surface to which he was leading his people. Deuteronomy 11, verse 8. Therefore, shall ye keep all the commandments which I command you this day, that ye may be strong and go in and possess the land whither ye go to possess it, and that ye may prolong your days in the land which Yahweh sware unto your fathers to give unto them and to their seed, a land that floweth with milk and honey. For the land whither thou goest in to possess, it is not as the land of Egypt from whence ye came out, where thou sowest thy seed and waterest with thy foot as a garden of herbs. That's a reference to the way in which they needed to scrape irrigation channels, of course. God says it's not a land like that. Verse 11, but the land whither ye go to possess it is a land of hills and valleys, and drinketh water of the rain of heaven, a land which Yahweh thy God careth for. The eyes of Yahweh thy God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year even unto the end of the year. Now, brothers and sisters, there is no other land upon the face of this globe about which we read words such as that. No other land. We do not read it of Britain. We do not read it of America. We do not read it of Australia. We do not read it of France, Belgium, Africa, or anywhere else upon the face of this globe. Those words, brothers and sisters, are absolutely unique. And the land to which they relate is absolutely unique. That's why it's designated in the scriptures. And in Ezekiel 38 in particular, God says, it is my land. And it is my people, he says. Those words are absolutely unique. A land which God careth for. The eyes of Yahweh thy God are always upon it from the beginning of the year even unto the end of the year. Consequently, when God gave his law through Moses to Israel, there were specific commandments concerning the land, were there not? The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, says Leviticus chapter 25, verse 23. In fact, in Hosea 9, verse 3, it is specifically referred to there as Yahweh's land. And Israel were warned that if they departed from the precepts of God, they would be removed from his land. I will pluck them up by the roots out of my land, which I have given them, says 2 Chronicles 7, verse 20. And so it's obvious then from those words which you've just read there in Deuteronomy and many other places besides, that the land of Israel has a unique role. It has a unique position in the purpose of God. As also, of course, have God's people of Israel a unique role, a unique purpose in God's sight. Just turn back a few chapters into the 7th chapter of Deuteronomy. And here we read how God has chosen the Jews to be a special and a peculiar people unto himself. And he also tells us here why that is the case. The 7th chapter of Deuteronomy, verse 6. For thou art an holy people unto Yahweh thy God. Yahweh thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. He did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, for ye were the fewest of all, but because Yahweh loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your fathers. And so there we have it, brothers and sisters, a special land and a special people. Now, since those words were written, of course, a lot has happened. A lot has happened to God's land, and a lot has happened to God's people. The punishments that God predicted he would bring upon Israel if they departed from his ways ultimately came to pass. They were invaded. They were taken into captivity, and the land was subjected to foreign domination. Eventually, the Jews were driven out of the land altogether, and they ceased to exist as a nation, and they were hounded and they were persecuted and chased into every corner of the land, into every corner of the globe, exactly as the verses that we looked at in Deuteronomy 28 have prophesied. And that state of affairs continued for 1900 years. But miraculously, during all that time, the Jews never lost their national identity. They had no homeland of their own. But God ensured that they did not die out as a race. They were never absorbed by the countries into which God had driven them. Far from it. They maintained all along their own particular culture, their own particular religion, their own particular way of life. God even ensured that their physical features were maintained, their distinctive physical features. The dark black hair and the prominent nose. During all that length of time, brothers and sisters, such that one can still to this day quite easily recognize a Jew in the main, not always, but quite frequently one can. And that, of course, was something that played against them over the years, in that they were easily identified by their enemies and very easily persecuted and chased and hounded and put to death, in that the majority of them were easily identifiable. One can tell a Jew, usually, just by looking at his face. But all that, brothers and sisters, was in the outworking of God's purpose. God had said that they would be scattered. God had said that they would be persecuted. God had said that everyone's hand would be against them. And that was just one feature that made it easy for the Gentile nations to do so and to carry out God's purpose and his will in doing so, in that they were easily identified. The fact remains that the Jews are God's people. He has a purpose with them, and he will soon be bringing that purpose to a completion. Now, the Apostle Paul asks this question, and it's in Romans 11, verse 1. We won't turn to it. He says, "Hath God cast away his people?" And he answers it immediately. He says, "By no means. God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew." Quite categorically he states that. God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. Let's turn, shall we, to the 30th chapter of the book of Jeremiah. Here in Jeremiah chapter 30 we have a prophecy written about 2,500 years ago, which the Apostle Paul could well have used as the basis for the reasoning of those words of his that we've just quoted from Romans 11 verse 1. He could well have used these words as the basis of his reasoning. Jeremiah 30 verse 10. Therefore fear thou not, O my servant Jacob, saith Yahweh, neither be dismayed, O Israel, for lo, I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of their captivity, and Jacob shall return, and shall be in rest, and be quiet, and none shall make him afraid. For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. Now the next chapter, Jeremiah 31, verse 7. For thus saith Yahweh, sing with gladness for Jacob, and shout among the chief of the nations, publish ye, praise ye, and say, O Yahweh, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I will bring them from the north country, and gather them from the coasts of the earth, and with them the blind and the lame, the woman with child, and her that travaileth with child together, a great company shall return thither. Verse 10, hear the word of Yahweh, O ye nations, and declare it in the isles afar off, and say, he that scattered Israel will gather him, and keep him as a shepherd doth his flock. And then move on to verse 35 of the same chapter. Chapter 31, verse 35. Thus saith Yahweh, which giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and the stars for a light by night, which divideth the sea when the waves thereof roar, Yahweh of hosts is his name. If those ordinances depart from before me, saith Yahweh, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. And if, verse 37, the heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, if, says God, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith Yahweh. And so there, surely, we have the basis upon which Paul, no doubt, based his reasoning for those words which we have quoted from him when he spoke in his epistle to the Romans, chapter 11, verse 1. God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. Now, we won't turn to it because we are, no doubt, familiar with the chapter. But in Ezekiel chapter 37, we have there a prophecy of the restoration of the Jews and the re-establishment of Israel as a nation. A similar prophecy to some of the words that we've just looked at there in the early verses of Jeremiah 31. But it's significant, of course, brothers and sisters, that in the chronological sequence of events set forth in Ezekiel's prophecy, the chapter that tells us of the return of the Jews to the land and the re-establishment of the nation of Israel is then followed by the 38th chapter, which tells of its invasion. The point being, of course, that whilst we haven't yet seen the total fulfillment of the 37th chapter, because the second half of that chapter, of course, gives us a grand sweep forward into the time of the kingdom, nevertheless, we feel that there is sufficient of the 37th chapter already fulfilled to enable the prophetic events detailed in Ezekiel chapter 38 to be imminent. You see, it's now 43 years since the re-establishment of the nation of Israel in May 1948. And during that time, the return of the Jews from over 70 different countries scattered throughout the globe has resulted in the modern state of Israel as we see it today, with its capital in Jerusalem and a total population which is now fast approaching 4.5 million people. Even so, of course, there are still far more Jews living outside Israel than there are in the nation, in the land itself. We understand that there are more Jews in the United States of America than there are in the land of Israel. And so we're still only seeing a token fulfillment of the prophecies of the restoration. But that matters not, brothers and sisters, just at the moment. The important thing is that Israel is a nation once again, and has been for 43 years now. The land is no longer waste and desolate, but is inhabited by a people who have been gathered out of the nations of the world, exactly as God had predicted. And so as far as God's land is concerned, and the resettlement of 4.5 million of his people, the requirements of chapter 38 of Ezekiel are there, are they not? The desolate places are now inhabited. Verse 12. It is a land which is now brought back from the sword. Verse 8. They are a people who have been gathered out of the nations, and who have gotten to themselves cattle and goods. Verse 12 again. And that dwell in the midst of the land. They dwell confidently, settled in a homeland of their own. And the stage is now set for the fulfillment of the remainder of this chapter, namely the invasion of their land by the Confederacy of Gog. Now, of that invasion, we read in Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 14, "In that day, when my people of Israel dwell safely or confidently, shalt thou not know it?" Speaking to Gog. And we then read in verses 15 and 16 of Gog taking advantage of that knowledge and coming down into Israel out of the north parts. Now, Russia has already tried various means of dominating the Middle East by using the Arab nations as her pawns, but each time she has tried, it has met with dismal failure. She armed and she financed Egypt and other Arab nations in the what turned out to be just 6 days' war. In 1967. But in the events that followed, Egypt abandoned much of that equipment. £4.5 million worth of arms and equipment were left lying in the sand, and they fled before the victorious Israeli armies. And since that time, of course, Egypt has abandoned her ties with Russia and has now entered into a peace treaty with Israel. Iraq has been financed and equipped and bolstered by Russia. And until recently, she had the fourth largest army in the world. Recent events in the Gulf, of course, have much reduced her military capacity, such that she is now in the grip of civil unrest and can no longer sustain an attack against Israel with any hope of success, despite her intense hatred of the things of Zionism. There are other Arab nations that Russia could use, but Russia must inevitably be coming to the conclusion that if she is to come down into, that if she is to gain control of the oil supplies of the Middle East, she has to come down into the Middle East, and she must do it for herself. And she must also have realized by now that to dominate the Middle East, one must first dominate Israel. And thus, although Israel has no oil fields of its own, the conquest of Israel provides the key, the strategy, towards eventual domination of those nations that have oil and that have it in abundance, great abundance. And so we see then that Israel is a nation whose importance cannot be overestimated. We've already read of Israel's importance as far as God is concerned, how that his eyes are always upon the land, and such that when it is invaded, his fury will come up into his face. But the world also recognizes the importance of Israel, does it not? From a totally different point of view, of course. Israel is the only country in the Middle East that is totally pro-West. It is also the most powerful country in the Middle East. Its survival, therefore, is imperative as far as Britain and America are concerned. Absolutely imperative. The Arab states see Israel as their common enemy and are committed to its destruction. And Russia sees the conquest of Israel as the strategic springboard to eventual world domination by gaining a stranglehold upon its vital oil supplies of the Middle East. And all that about a country so tiny that on a map of the world the actual name Israel has to be printed outside the land, otherwise it would obliterate the cartographical outline of the land. And yet, despite its small size, the nation of Israel is constantly in the world's headlines. And God has arranged, of course, that this should be the case, that his land and his people should be the constant focus of world attention. But sadly, brothers and sisters, how few people in the world bother to open and search the scriptures to see why this should be the case. And yet the signs and the indications that herald Christ's second coming are there in advance. But we also know, do we not, that all those things that have happened to Israel hitherto are going to pale into insignificance compared with that which is predicted for Israel in the future. They are going to be invaded. They are going to be overrun by a confederacy from the north, as described in Ezekiel chapter 38. They're going to have two-thirds of the Jewish inhabitants of the land destroyed. We're told that in Zechariah chapter 13, verse 8. They're going to have God intervene on their behalf and for him to fight for them as he fought for them in the day of battle. Zechariah 14, verse 5. 3, rather. Such that the northern confederacy shall come to his end and none shall help him, says Daniel 11, verse 45. And the Jews will then be humbled, disciplined, purged, and refined. Their numbers vastly increased by a massive immigration of Jews from other lands, brought about by Elijah, whose mission will be to go to the Jews that are still in exile and tell them that Messiah has returned and to gather them to him. And so, ultimately, God's people, having been re-educated in divine principles and having acknowledged Christ as Saviour and King, will be granted a position of grace and favour before him, ultimately, that the fulfilment of those glorious things that God has prophesied for them might indeed come to pass. That's the ultimate picture for Israel, Brentford. But, of course, a lot has to happen before then. And so let's look very briefly in the few minutes that remain at just a few details of how Israel and Jerusalem in particular will fare when the land is invaded by this confederacy of Gog. Turn to Zechariah chapter 14. In the closing verses of the previous chapter, we're told that two-thirds of the Jews that are then in the land will be destroyed in their attempts to defend their homeland against the aggressor. And their efforts turn out to be futile. Equally so are the attempts by those nations that will seek to help them, the Tarshish powers. Their efforts will also be futile. And it will seem that nothing can stop the onslaught. Zechariah 14, verse 1, behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. We may wonder why it only speaks of half of the city going into captivity. Well, look at Jerusalem as we see it today. It consists of part Israeli citizens and part Palestinians. It will be the Jewish half that will go into captivity. The Palestinian half will greet the Russian armies as their liberators, come to free them from the oppression of so-called Zionism. And then, of course, this is the time when God's fury is to come up into his face. Verse 3, then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. And then in the verses that follow, we have a prophecy of the way in which God will intervene in that battle through Christ and his saints, who will pour out the judgments of God upon those people who have come down to spoil God's land and to spoil his people. Verse 4, and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and towards the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. And you shall flee the mountain of the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azal. Yea, ye shall flee like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah king of Judah. And Yahweh, my Elohim, shall come, and all the saints with thee. We won't go into those verses in any more detail, brothers and sisters, because it is not our subject, and the remainder of what we read there, of course, will be dealt with in the studies as we proceed. But we would like to make one important point by way of conclusion, that we might finish on an exhortational note. However familiar we are, brothers and sisters, with the prophecies of Ezekiel chapter 38 and the invasion of Israel, it is highly likely, brothers and sisters, that we will not see those things come to pass. Not in our present circumstances anyway, because we believe, do we not, that we will be taken away for judgment before these things come to pass. That has to be the case when we think about it, because we've just read there in verses 4 and 5 of Zechariah chapter 14 of God intervening in that battle through Christ and his saints. Verse 4 is often looked upon as a description of the second coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. It is actually the revealing or the apocalypse of Christ and the saints to the world, because as far as the household of faith is concerned, Jesus will have already have come by then. He will have raised the dead and gathered them together with those that are alive at his coming to judgment. We must all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And so in the divine timetable of events, therefore, the return of Christ to his ecclesia, the judgment of the household of faith, must have already have taken place before the events of verses 4 and 5 of this chapter can be fulfilled, because it speaks of Christ coming with his saints. And so in view of all this, brothers and sisters, it's more than likely that the return of the Lord Jesus Christ will take place before Russia even makes its move to come down into the land of Israel. We certainly know, brothers and sisters, from the scriptures that there will be an element of surprise and unexpectedness about Christ's return, even to the household of faith, even to those that are looking for him. And this, brothers and sisters, might well be the reason. We speak of crises in the Middle East as being the herald of Christ's return. So they are, brothers and sisters. But that final crisis might well not take place until after Christ has returned and shown himself to his ecclesia. And so we need to give careful heed and careful thought to the warning and the exhortation that Jesus offered when he said, "Be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh." Or as we read in Revelation 16, verse 15, "Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame."